Hey, everybody. Welcome back to a brand new Ike Live show. I hope you're having a wonderful Sunday. I know we are. Got a special show for you tonight. Joining us in a couple minutes, we've got the one and only Tripp Weldon joining us. I cannot wait to get Tripp on the phone and talk to him and catch up with Tripp. Let me remind you, if you're watching over on Facebook, Riz, we're doing the like and share contest. All you have to do is like and share the Facebook feed, and you're going to be entered into a chance to win the world-famous Ike Live gift bag. Load it with sponsor products. If you're watching over on the other social channels, it's at Ike Live Show, and we're going to be monitoring those as well. But if you're watching on IkeLive.com, Riz, we want their comments. Yeah. We want their questions, right? Send them through.
Yep, we want to hear from you.
We want to hear from you. Very, very important part of the show. Before we get started, as we do every week, we want to thank our military men and women, active and veterans. Thank you guys for what you do. It's a crazy world right now. It's so crazy. Policemen, firemen, EMT, doctors, nurses, thank you guys for what you do. Strange, strange world. I want to get started, Brian. This is one of these shows where, you know, sometimes you get a guest on and you're like, keep him in the waiting room for a while. But this is one where I don't care about anything else that's going on right now. You know what I mean? It's that kind of show.
I was just messaging with somebody who's coming on later. And,
yeah.
A little surprised. And I don't know if I've ever even really had a conversation with Tripp, but somehow I feel like I really know him.
Right.
And I'm so excited to have him on or just to be a part of this. To be a spectator to this.
Yeah. And that happens a lot. I've seen that happen in other walks of life. You feel like you know somebody, even you don't. But I really do know this guy, and I am so excited to finally get him on the Ike Live show. I know we've talked about this. The stars and the moon have not aligned correctly all those years. Finally, they have. And joining us live, the one and only, the world's best ever tournament director, Tripp Weldon, joins us live.
Tripp.
Woo!
Tripp, Akinetti.
How are you doing, Tripp?
I'm good, my friend. How are you?
I'm very good. It's so good to see you. It's so good to hear your voice. First things first, how you feeling? How you doing? Fill us in.
Well, I feel good. I appreciate you asking. I appreciate all the thoughts and prayers sent our way, but I feel good. For those that don't know, I have non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. Hopefully I don't have it anymore. I did 6 chemo treatments. I have a full body scan the end of the month, and I'll get my results 1st of April. But the doctor's saying good things, and I'm clinging to what he's saying, man. I'm back fishing. I told Pete I fished a tournament right here on Lake Jordan yesterday and getting my stamina back. So I feel good.
That's awesome. It's awesome to hear. In fact, I was with we had a field lacrosse game for Estella today. It was her first game. And Uncle Don was there. And Uncle Don wanted me to tell you hello and glad you're doing well. And Uncle Don's thinking about you more than you know. So.
Well, tell him I appreciate that. And miss seeing all you guys, miss seeing him. And I know he went through the same thing. And I appreciate your text to me, reaching out to me, Mike, back when I was diagnosed.
Yeah, for sure. I got to ask you this because I know I've had this conversation, you know, with my uncle. We've had this conversation with Aaron. We've had Aaron on about a couple months ago, yeah. Brian.
Right.
And just in the beginning of the show, you know, we talked about Mark Jeffries had an accident last week, you know, a near-death accident last week. What's this – how this experience – it's – I know it's life-changing. Tell me about it, Tripp.
It is. I mean, you know, when you hear the C word, it is definitely life-changing.
Yeah.
And I've been very fortunate, though. You hear all the horror stories about chemo, and different people react different ways.
Yeah.
I had good days and bad days, but I never threw up. I never had any of the nausea and the sickness type stuff that people had. I tried to stay ahead of it with nausea medicine if I felt like something was coming on. But,
yeah.
You know, my first treatment was pretty rough because I think as much mentally as it is physically, you come to a stop sign in life and go a totally different direction. And
yeah.
We kind of experienced that with Ben, our youngest son. He's a type 1 diabetic. He found out 3 days before he graduated high school. And so we've been through, you know, the diabetic deal with him, but my other treatments weren't too bad. You know, it would hit me 7 to 10 days after my treatments. Really lost a lot of stamina, but I've tried to exercise and lift weights and build up my stamina. I fished a tournament yesterday. By the end of the day, man, I'm totally gassed.
But
I fished the first one I fished, I quit at 12 o'clock. I had Ben take me in at 12 o'clock. So I lasted all day the last couple of tournaments I fished. So
that's awesome.
But yes, it is a life-changing experience. It makes you really count your blessings and learn to live each day, one day at a time, and make the best of life.
So true. So important. We've talked about that a lot on the show, and it's so important to do that. I want to jump right to the second thing, which is congratulations on your retirement, Tripp. I don't think I got a chance to say that to you. You had a amazing career with Bass. You know, in my opinion, you've helped advance the sport. But I know, you know, in talking with you, my few last years of Bass, I kind of knew it was coming. How did you know it was the right time for retirement? And I asked you this because these are some of the things I'm struggling with right now. You know, I'm at a crossroads in my career. So did you know this was time? Did you have this planned? How did the retirement happen?
Well, I had planned to retire this year. I didn't know when, and of course the Classic was scheduled in the spring, and then COVID changed all of that. But then back up to my whole cancer deal, and I turned 65 in January, and the first Elite was in February, and I knew I wouldn't be able to travel just because of my stamina and just my health in general.
Yeah.
So the timing was right. I was going through all the Medicare stuff and so I knew it was the right time. I prayed about it. We prayed about it, and we just knew the timing was right. But my plan the last 3 or 4 years was to retire sometime this year.
Gotcha. Yeah. Gotcha. Well, it's funny because, I've heard you speak in a few other articles about this, but I do want to talk about it tonight. It's interesting how life takes you places, and we've had a lot of amazing guests on the show, from fishermen to athletes to celebrities, who talk about, you know, how they ended up where they're at. I want you to go back, Tripp, and a lot of our viewers and listeners don't know the story, but how did you end up as the tournament director for Bass? Because it's kind of crazy, right? It's like one of those things where it's like, you know, I think we might have some viewers saying, you know, were you in eighth grade aspiring to be the best tournament director ever in the world, or is it something that happened? Phil, give us that story.
Well, I'll try to make it brief. My story with Bass, I actually grew up 2 blocks from the original Bass headquarters.
Wow.
In Capitol Heights in Montgomery, Alabama.
Wow.
And I grew up fishing just like you guys, any kind of fishing I could do, brim fishing, crappie fishing. It didn't matter. As long as I was fishing, I was happy. And I got into a bass club in the late 70s. In 1981, Bass came to Montgomery for the Classic. It was the first indoor weigh-in. Stanley Mitchell won it. And I was a volunteer camera boat driver. And Dewey Kendrick was a volunteer tow vehicle driver. And that's where we first met.
Wow.
We were volunteers the following year, came back to Montgomery in 82. And then Dewey called me in 1990 to interview for his assistant tournament director, and the rest is history. In 2002, I was appointed tournament director at Bass when ESPN owned Bass. And it's one of those deals, Mike, where I say you have your runs in life, and I've had my run. I'm retired. And,
yeah.
Enjoying life, but I'm still following. You know, I was on there today looking at Bass Track and looking at the leaderboard and all that good stuff. But I'm glad I wasn't there this week making decisions on the weather.
I know.
That's a tough week.
I know. I know. It's funny because I thought that same thing. And I and I follow it too. You know, I'm a fish head. I'll always be a fish head. But what I thought was interesting, and I read this somewhere, but I want to give everyone a reality check here. And Riz, how old are you again?
30.
Okay, Riz is 30. Trip, we've got a lot of younger folks watching and listening right now, and they're so used to, you know, it's so easy, right? You grab your phone, you get your tablet, and you're watching. You're seeing the update. You're seeing it live. Take me back, Trip, when you were a fan. I had read this somewhere that you used to call the hotline. This is pre-internet, wow, pre-cell phone, pre-computer, all that stuff. What? You used to call the hotline to find
That's
out
right,
who
dinosaur.
Was...
Yeah, dinosaur days. I called the 272-9530 was the number in Montgomery, and I would call the hotline every day of every tournament.
That's
and
awesome.
Most of the times when you'd call it, it'd be busy. That was the only way you could get an update on the tournaments, unless you waited 30 days until Bassmaster Magazine came out. Then Bass Times came out, and it was a little more current, although it might be 2 or 3 weeks behind. But yes, I used to do that every day of every tournament.
Wow.
What were the
updates? I
listened
to Ann Lewis. You remember Ann Lewis?
I do. Yeah.
I would listen to her. She would do a recording every night of the tournament, an update. Yep.
No kidding. What would she run down the leaderboard and their weights and that
She'd
kind
run
of
down
stuff?
The leaderboard and give a quick highlight of the day. You know, Pete Glusick caught his fish today fishing docks with a jig and so Game forth. Bowl. But it was a quick 5-minute rundown. So,
wow.
Yep, I did that almost every day.
Wow. I don't remember that.
That is amazing. That is unbelievable. That is
I mean, when you look at it nowadays and the technology and it's, you know, like what we're seeing with forward facing sonar and all that. I mean, it's technology, man, is I don't know. It moves in warp speed too. It's crazy.
It's crazy.
One of my favorite things about like learning the history of the sport is seeing how deep the commitment was. It was for to be a fan at the beginning and like to be a student of the game at the beginning of this of the sport as it grew.
Yeah.
That is like it gives you a charge.
Oh
like,
yeah. Well like, I can jump in and say I don't remember calling the hotline, but I remember like dying to watch the shows, right? And it wasn't instantaneous, right? There wasn't any of that. But I remember being a kid, and Pete, we've talked about this before. I remember being in grade school, and I could not wait to watch Bassmasters. You know, that theme song, like, it energized me. It's like, and Tripp, do you remember the one, I can't remember the era, but it was Larry from
Nixon.
From Mega Bass. From the Mega Bucks tournament.
Tournament. And oh my God, look at the size of that.
Dude, every time that fish jumped.
My God, what a bass.
Yeah, every time that fish jumped, I'd get chills. I'd be like, oh,
he's got
my
pistol grip rod. Oh, it's like 3.5 feet long.
Oh yeah. But
those
it's
were fun times, man. Good
oh
times.
Yeah. But it's great because you know you look at 30, 40 years ago and today. And I think anglers are just as passionate, right? Technology's changed, things have changed, but the anglers are still passionate. And that's awesome. You know, you need that to help grow the sport.
Mike, I know you didn't probably call the hotline.
Yeah.
But I do remember you calling from the we had a payphone in our high school gymnasium.
Yeah.
And I remember you would call 1-800-BASS-PRO because it was a
to order tackle?
Just to call him.
Just to call him.
Because it was an 800 number.
That's
You could do that from the payphone.
I was probably ordering tackle from high school, which was pretty...
Or cranking them.
Yeah, or crank calling them, which is pretty bad.
Mike, do you remember at the trailer, like back before the information age, we used to have to wait for the printouts.
Yeah.
You know, we were in the hunt for the classic, and you know... You'd have to sit there for half hour, whatever it took.
Nerve wracking.
For those sheets, and you'd go up to the trailer, the Bass trailer, and they'd hand you out a sheet, let you know where you stood. That's how you did it back then.
Yeah.
And it was crazy. You know, you're right, Pete. And it was, it took forever, and we had to make you'd have 25, 30, 35 anglers waiting outside the trailer at classic time. And you're running copies on this copy machine. It's like, There's one copy. There's two copies. You know, it took forever. And man, times have changed.
But I'm addicted to it, though. I gotta be honest. I watched the live. I cannot stop. I must hit refresh on Bass Tracks like 1,000 times the tournament.
Yeah.
I gotta keep up with it. It's really
They've done a good Bass Track. They've done a good job with that this year too. It really looks good.
Yeah. It looks good. I want to ask this. I had this in my notes. Your job description is
tough.
Is a tough one, right? Like a normal job. You know, you work at. You're an IT guy, right? You can list off 10 things that you do. But the role of a tournament director is a difficult one, and there's not a lot of, you know, it can go far left, it could go far right. There's a million things. How did you get good at it, Tripp? That's what I want to know. I know you worked under Dewey. Is talk about that. How did you get that confidence? How did you get the ability to be a world-class tournament director?
Well, I think being an angler certainly played a huge part in it. Dewey was my mentor, obviously, but being a tournament fisherman and knowing what you guys go through and just knowing how the game works, I think it made a huge difference. It is an odd occupation or whatever there. I mean, job description, as you would say, odd is probably the wrong word, different. Might be a more appropriate word, but I think just the experience, when I became assistant tournament director, I was still fishing. I mean, I was fishing red man tournaments, and a lot of team tournaments. And then in the late 80s, I still had the itch to be a professional angler and went part time. And that's when Pete, I'm still mad at him. He beat me on that. But no, he had a great week. But I scratched that itch and knew that's kind of what I wanted to do. And I think we had a great team. You know, we had good people at Bass. And you surround yourself with good people and do the best job you can. You work hard at it every day.
Yeah, that's incredible. Pete, I wanted to stop you for a second and say I remember that tournament because I was in that tournament too, so I remember it. But, Pete, did you feel bad winning that tournament? I mean, because you're probably one of the nicest guys I know. I'm not just saying that because you're my friend, Pete, but you're nice. Did you feel bad about winning that tournament, Pete?
No. Man, I was desperate for my moment. I mean, I was like, I was just battling to get the, you know how it was, like we're talking about the limited technology. You didn't get, I mean, you finished second place, you got like one sentence in Bassmaster magazine, maybe, you know, you got to win that sucker to get, you know, get the coverage, to get the sponsors and all that other stuff.
Pete had a great week. I had a terrible day too. I stunk it up big time, but Pete was consistent and had a great week. And, it was a good job, man.
Did you ever hear how I found those fish, Tripp? I don't know if I've ever told you this story, and it might make you mad, or I don't know. No. We had how Kalijah Creek gets foggy, and it was real foggy on our practice day. I think our last one, and I launched, and no GPS, none of that stuff. So I'm trying to get to this cove that I wanted to start my practice day, and I couldn't. So I'm idling and I'm losing shoreline. I'm kind of getting spun around. It's so thick you can't see the trolling motor, you know, when you're idling and all of a sudden I notice on my sonar just a little high spot comes up, and two fish were marked on what looked like a stump. That's where I won the tournament.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And I didn't. As a matter of fact, I had to stay there to wait for the fog to lift so that I could get back there again.
Wow.
Yeah, I remember it was like 80 degrees in practice. And then we had a bad front come through. I think it was the night after the first competition day. And that's I do right. remember day two was real windy and cold. And like I say, I didn't have a plan B. I had plan A, and that was it. Plan A worked on the first and third day, but I stunk it up on day two.
I remember you were jerk baiting, I think, a Lucky Craft when those were just coming out. At least that's what I thought that I heard. That you were jerk baiting around the docks or something like
that. No, that was Everstart I won down there. I was actually kept throwing skipping a jig under docks.
Docks and pontoons. Docks and pontoons. I remember.
Docks and pontoons. Yep.
I remember. Yep. Pete's favorite fog on the message board. Just throw that out there. I've actually got a really good story too. I want to just throw out there. And Uncle Don reminded me of it at the game tonight. And I don't know if you remember this trip, but I got to relay this story. So we have literally been working together my entire career, Trip, whether you know this or not. So I was lucky enough in 1993 to get drawn as a co-angler, as an amateur, in the BASS. I think they were top. Were they top 100s or 150s back then?
Top 100s.
100s. Yeah, in 93. The first one I got drawn for, I was a college student, and I did really poorly. But I had an amazing time. I drew a Fritz, Cliff Craft, Gary Klein, and one other guy my first year. I didn't do very good. The next year I put in for two more. I didn't get drawn for the one. But I got drawn for the exact same location again, Norman, which was right? Lake Norman in North Carolina.
Yep.
And I went on in that one to have some great draws as well. Guido Hibden, Cliff Craft again, Chet Dalfit.
How was the first time you were with Craft?
The first time I was with Craft was he didn't care about hooks. I remember he had the worst. He had like saltwater trebles. On his top water, and he didn't care. And I remember being a co-angler looking at him like, are you not going to change these hooks? I'm looking at these like silver anodized hooks, and I'm like, you're the professional. But the second year, I was having a good event. By the third day, back then, Trip, you remember they were four-day events. And by the third day, I was leading, had a very slim lead. And, I had drove there with my uncle. And so it was, this is crazy. Like, this was a family affair. So it was me as a college student, my uncle, my grandfather. We were all in my uncle's van. And at the time, he drove these, like, panel vans almost. Like, he was a van guy, right?
Passenger van.
Yeah. In the 70s, yeah. He was a van guy. And at the end of the third day, he went up to you, Trip, and because you were working that one. And you didn't know Don from, Adam, And Don asked you, he said, hey, my nephew Mike's winning this. And, he's going to win the tournament. And, there's still a day left, And he asked you, he said, would you guys give us the hitch for the boat when he wins? And Don said, you just looked at him like, like he had like three heads, like, do we give you the hitch? No, we don't get. And like, we've never towed a boat before, so that whole nine. But he had enough confidence in me, Trip, that morning of the last day, he went to a U-Haul dealer and had a hitch installed on his van. And I ended up winning that tournament. So.
Oh, cool.
That was.
Cool.
That,
I do.
Yeah.
I do not remember that.
Yes.
And I don't. Ever recall again someone asking me for a trip? So.
That's how green we were back then.
Wow.
But man, what a history that we have, Trip.
That was a neat story.
Yeah, it's a great story. And I got to tell you, this is a great moment for me to tell you something. I know we're far away. You're in Alabama. I'm in New Jersey. But I want to look in the camera, look you in the eye, and say that the years that I tournament fished, I cannot thank you enough for being a great tournament director all those years. There were days where I disagreed with some of the decisions that you made, but I never disagreed with how hard you worked and your commitment to the sport and growing the sport. So I just wanted to say thank you. I don't think I ever told you that. Thank you very much, Trip.
Well, thank you, Mike. I appreciate that. And I love all the anglers. I love you guys. And some decisions you make, you know, are tough decisions. And were we always perfect? No, absolutely not. And so, but I appreciate what you say, and I respect you guys immensely and what y'all do.
Yeah. Well, we really, really do appreciate it. I want to go back. What were some of the tougher decisions you've had to make in your career? Because I know, like, every tournament there's a tough one, right? You got to make a judgment.
And how do you get good at that?
Like, yeah,
how do you get used to making those tough decisions?
It's so hard. I can't even wrap my hands around that pressure, you know, of that every day of every tournament. But are there ones that you look back on and you're like, oh my God, I was pulling my hair out in that one? Are there ones that stand out as being the toughest or some of the toughest decisions you ever had to make?
You know, I've shared this on other shows. The weather delays and canceled days and all that, I didn't lose too much sleep over it. You know, I tell anglers all the time, I'm not going to apologize trying to keep you safe.
Right.
Were there days where we probably could have fished? Probably so.
Yeah.
You know, there was the one at Amistad where we canceled a day and it was beautiful down there, 100 miles from us. It was blowing 18 wheelers off the road. So,
right.
You know, those are judgment calls. Disqualifications and that sort of deal. You know, first of all, you never let it be personal.
Right.
You know, it was tough to call KBD and tell him he was disqualified at Santee Cooper.
Yeah.
Same way with Hagney at Cayuga and Swindle at the Classic, because, you know, I love all those guys and respect them. And
yeah.
And to a man, they took it like men. You know, it was not easy, but again, you don't make it personal. And so you try to stick by the rule book and do the best job you can keep that respect for the anglers and hope they respect, you know, what we're trying to do as tournament officials.
Yeah. Yeah. It's tough. And I'll remember, you know, I've had a few moments too that were not my finest moments, Trip. And I have a little list of a few of them here that I like to bring up.
Little list.
2004 on Lake Wylie, second day of the tournament. You had to disqualify me. And again, you know, I look back on it and I was in the wrong. I didn't have a good handle on exactly what the off limits was, and it was hard.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And I remember, you know, it was semi early in my career, and it's, and you know, when you're young and you're full of fire and energy, and you know, you don't want to make mistakes. And you know, I remember people accusing me on that one of saying, oh, you did that on purpose.
I've heard that a lot.
Oh, yeah. I remember, like to this day, Bernie Schultz is sure that I did it on purpose.
Yeah.
And I did not. It was honestly a misunderstanding. But it was tough, and I remember that. You know, there were a lot of those that we had over the years, Trip. And some of them were hard to swallow. But again, you know, especially now that I'm older and I'm a little more removed, it's gotta be tough, Trip, to make those decisions. You know, it's gotta be, because you're trying to do the right thing and you're trying to remove yourself. Have you ever second guessed a decision that you've made over the years?
I think you always. You reflect back on what could I have done different, you know, what could we have done different.
Yeah.
And I think the rule book evolves from those, some of those moments. You know, when I first became tournament director, there were three penalties for rules violation. One was loss of catch for the day, loss of catch for the tournaments, two. And then a ban from bass was three. That was it.
Right.
And then after the Swindle deal at the Classic, you know, I said, we've got to change this. We've got to have something that's more appropriate for the penalty. And that's where the penalty box came up.
Yeah.
And, you know, yeah. and several of the other rules. So, yeah, but I think you look back at every decision and you go back, I'll go back to what you said about pulling your hair out. You have to have hair first, Mike, to pull it out. No, I had a lot of sleepless nights, you know, over decisions you make. And because you know it affects people's career, or if it affects the tournament, it could affect their career. But I tell people, and I've told the other tournament directors, you know, you look at the field, if it's 100 anglers and one guy steps out of bounds, you got to think about those 99 guys that are inbounds.
Right, right.
And that's how you have to look at it.
Yeah. That's a great way to look at it. I want to double back real quick, Trip, on weather delays, weather cancellations. You brought it up. We all watched this week as Bass postponed the event for a few days because of, you know, high water, wind, potential storms, right? That's a tough thing, and I looked from afar and I saw some of the anglers posting these beautiful calm water in the morning in the back, right? And you know, you wonder if those are the right decisions. But I'd want to talk in generality of the old days versus the new days. And I know just in my time, Trip, I remember the events like, you know, late 90s, mid 90s to early 2000s, you guys didn't keep us back from a lot at all. Like, I remember the classic in Chicago.
Cowboy days.
I mean, dude, 12 footers on Lake Michigan. Go! I remember Thousand Island opens out of Clayton where, you know, there's a straight west wind blowing right into the river. Go! You know, I remember those days. Is it right that that it seems like we're living in a more cautious time with tournaments, or should we go back to those days where you fish regardless, right? It's almost up to the angler, you know, on what to do.
That's a good question. I don't know that I can answer it. You know, those days you're talking about were in 17 foot boats with a 150 too.
Oh yeah. Yep.
Yeah. They weren't 20, 21 foot
right.
Boats. Yep. But, you know, we have so much technology, so much at your disposal now. I know the last, I don't know, 6 or 8 years, every day when my feet hit the floor, first thing I do is grab my phone and look at the weather.
Right.
You know, and see what the weather's doing. And so, and there's so much more involved now. You know, you have marshals, you have camera guys to think about what you're talking about. A lot of draw tournaments.
Yeah.
Both guys were, most of the times, were boaters in the tournament. One just lost the flip of a coin or let the other guy talk him out of going in his boat. And you had co-anglers that were tournament anglers as well. But so much more at your disposal now. And I think the world in general is more cautious now.
You're right.
Not near as reckless.
Yeah, you're right.
Trip, how much does like the 24-hour news cycle that we live in now have an effect on, you know, like you had to have experienced this as a tournament director, going from, you know, the early 2000s to the point that you retired. Things changed a lot, and now as soon as something happens in a tournament, if something bad, you know, God forbid happens, it's on social media, it's on you know, the feeds right away. Like, how much did that weigh on you as a tournament director, knowing that your decisions, you know, are going to be just magnified?
Yeah.
Well, I tell you, when I first became tournament director, man, I was in the chat rooms and, you know, trying to soak in as much information as I could, but I soon learned that part of social media, I just had to leave alone, especially the chat rooms, because it's so easy to be brave, with a keyboard in your hand, rather than face to face. And so, people will say anything, you know, before they know it. So I learned real quick to try to stay away from some of that stuff. You can't stay away from all of it. And, you're going to read it, you're going to hear it, and you just have to grow tough skin and let stuff roll off your back.
Yeah.
But it's not easy. I'll tell you that. It's not easy.
How long did that take, Tripp, from the time that you became a tournament director? Like, I know it wasn't instantaneous that you became a tournament director and you're like, all right, I can make all these decisions and just be bulletproof. Like, that has to take some time to build up that, you know, that mindset to just know that when a tough decision has to be made, you got to make it.
That's tough.
It took years. I mean, it's not easy, and it wasn't easy, last year or the year before. I mean, right up till the day I retired, some decisions are tough decisions. So you just put your head down and work and do the best you can. But the social media deal, it took me about 3 or 4 years. I said, I can't do these chat room deals. You know, I wouldn't respond, but I would read all the comments and stuff. And Mike, you know, they'll wreck you over the coals.
Oh, I know. Believe me, I know. I'm not even tournament fishing anymore, and they still rake me over the coals. Pete, I want your input on this real quick, what we're talking about. I mean, I get it, right? Times have changed. Tournaments are different now than they were 5, 10, 15, 20 years ago. We're in a different culture, right? We're in a cancel culture. Right now, right? We're in a culture where it's easier, you know, to not take a risk, just cancel it. And we've, you know, and I'm not taking anything away from any of these decisions, because we've had deaths and we've had injuries, and, you know, we're probably smarter for it now. But I miss the good old – I miss those days. I am telling you, like, there was something about just knowing that you were going – right, that you were going, that you, if you had waves to battle through, then that's part of the decision, right? Do you stay close? Do you battle those waves?
It's part of being an angler.
You know, if there were storms predicted, it's up to you, right? Did you want to take shelter? I miss that. I miss that Wild West element of it. Do you feel the same, Peter? Do you feel good about how the culture's changed?
No, Tripp, cancel that day.
Pete doesn't want to go.
I remember staying at the cabin on Thousand Islands. We were staying together in that one tournament, and the cabin's thin walls, and you can hear the leaves on the trees just and you're like, you wake up and you're like, oh no. Then you go outside and it blows you over, and you look at the flags and they're like so straight, like frozen, you know, and you're like, oh my God, it's got to be like 20 to 30 mile an hour winds. And then the forecast comes in and it says we got the Canadian weather, and it's like 3 to 4 meter waves out on Lake Ontario.
Meter.
And you're like, meter. Are you kidding me? But we've trained ourselves the entire time. Like, I remember we've had this conversation a million times. If you're going to fish Lake Thousand Islands, you got to go to the lake. If the wind blows, you got to go to the lake. Yeah. And I remember, I remember being out on Lake Ontario this day, and I was drifting. That's all I could manage to do. And I'm coming up on this shoal, and I didn't realize it got that shallow, and a 12-foot wave curled on me.
Oh my God.
I didn't know.
Brother.
Wow.
It curled on me literally, and it filled my boat up in just one instant. And I was level flotation now in these 10 to 12-foot seas.
Oh man.
And I was I was about 5 miles away from the mouth of Lake Ontario, or the St. Lawrence River. And I remember Mark Menendez, shout out to Mark Menendez, came by me and saw that I was clearly in distress. And, you know, I'm in the driver's seat and water's like up to my lower chest. And the waves were hitting me up around my neck as they would just roll right over the boat, you know, but my motor started. And it idled, and I was able to idle. And Mark Menendez, in the middle of the tournament, idled with me for about an hour. till I could get into the mouth of the river. And
Ike would have never done that, Pete.
I wouldn't have done that. I would have. Now listen, I would have stopped and put you in my boat with me. You want to ride back? I don't know if I would have idled for an hour. But
would not have idled
I probably him. Would not have. Yeah. Shout out to Mark Menendez. He's a good dude. So. He's a way better dude than I am.
Yeah. He was sitting on a good bag. So I'm in that instance, boy, I don't know. See, I'm skilled now. I know how to fish in that stupid, ridiculous 10-foot waves. I know how to do it now, and nobody should know how to do that. Right. You know?
No, I think you should though. Honestly, as a fisherman, if you're going to be on big water, you need to know how to handle those kinds of scenarios because it can get scary. You know.
But again, I get your point, Pete. And again, I'm not. I think safety should come first. But
absolutely.
That element of
you're alive.
You know, like those exciting moments, dangerous, scary moments. That's a part of the sport that I loved, and I'm glad I got to experience them. Let me remind everybody watching, we've got the world's best tournament director ever, Trip Weldon, on the show tonight. If you've got a question or a comment for Trip, please hit us up. Riz, we got a couple. Let's put a couple through.
Yeah, for sure. We got Dr. Kayak on the message board, and he wants you to know, Trip. Trip, I run some small local tournaments locally. And I look up to you, especially when I run the bigger events. Thanks for all that you did for Bass.
Nice.
And he also wants to know, Trip, can you share some light on the situation when Mike got in a fight with a dog on Great Lake?
Of course.
Oh, boy. You know, that's funny. I really didn't know about the dog until somebody told me about it.
Did the dog
protest? I just shrugged it off, That's Mike. It was no big deal to me. But, I appreciate your kind words.
That was a rough day for me equipment-wise. And I did, that was one of those ones where you take your anger and frustrations out on usually I do it on an inanimate object. It's a depth finder that I kick off the front or a rod. But that day
– windshield.
Right, windshield. But that day, that dog would not stop barking. He was on the end of the dock. I was having a bad day. I shouldn't have did it. It was one of those ones I shouldn't have did. But I did go back the next day. I fished that same little ridge. This was Grand Lake. It was a little ridge, little pre-spawn spot. I went back the next day. The craziest thing, Pete, that dog was still on the dock. The second day I went there, I apologized to him. And when I did that, he stopped barking.
No way.
He did. That's a true story. That was day three that happened. The dog did not bark after that. And to this day, we exchange Christmas cards every Christmas.
Beautiful.
That's awesome.
Yes, it's all good.
That's funny. Can I ask Trip a question? You've been doing this. You did this 30 years.
Yeah.
There had to be some egregious cheating that attempted to take place. I read where guys had a false live well in a boat and got caught in some buddy tournament trail, or putting coolers with fish in them going in the back of a creek and putting them in their live well. What was the most egregious thing that you saw during your tenure?
I guess the most egregious thing that I saw in a Bass event, I was not there, it was an open, was the guy had, I think it was an open, the guy had a fish tied to a line, and an angler caught it. You guys remember this, an angler hooked that line in practice, and he reported it to the tournament officials, who reported it to the Game and Fish. And they went out and marked the fish, and then the guy came through the weigh-in line with that fish.
Wow.
And you couldn't do anything until it's like shoplifting. You know, you got to get out of the store.
Right.
And so when he weighed the fish, our guy at the measuring table was clued in to the markings on that fish. And it was just like when it came through, he looked at the Game and Fish guy and just tipped his hat, gave him the signal. And the Game and Fish, of course, it was in their hands then.
Right.
They let him weigh the fish, and the angler stepped off stage, and they made the arrest.
Wow.
What kind of markings did they do?
it was something on the tail, I think. I think they either put
the tail or something,
punched a hole in the fin or the tail or something, but it was clear marking that they knew. And of course, you know, it was fraud and all that good stuff.
Damn.
But like I say, it was like shoplifting. They had let him come get outside the store before they made the arrest.
Was this the guy that fished like exposed hook jigs and would like, he would get the jig caught on that line and get it up the line and hook the fish legit? Like he would actually hook them because he had to fool his partner. Right, he had to find a way to trick his partner into that being a legitimate catch.
No, it wasn't. That wasn't this guy.
Okay.
No.
Wow.
That was another cheater.
Wow. I can tell you from my experience in tournament fishing is anytime you have money involved, right? And the more that money goes up, the more some guys will be willing to push. To push the boundaries. Now that's an extreme case, you know. But I think anytime you have that kind of money on the line, you have to deal with this kind of stuff. This is a good segue, Pete. I'm glad you asked that. Trip, you guys have used, Bass has used, now other circuits have used it and are using it, the polygraph for years.
Mm-hmm.
Do you believe that is and was a good system to enforce, you know, some of the rules amongst the anglers?
I think it's I've been asked that a bunch. I think it's one of the many tools you have in your tool chest as a tournament director. Mm. You know, we had when I was tournament director, we had great examiners. I did have a couple of squirrely ones that in other states, but most of the examiners we used were that we used full time were very good. And you know, there were, you know, like you give the test, and we, you know how we do it, Mike. We draw most of the time, we do it random draw, and you got a guy gets in there and the examiner asks questions before the exam. And you say, well, I had a guy come up to me at the gas station and say, I need to throw a black and blue jig.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the damage is done there on info.
Yeah.
And so you get the examiner would ask, rephrase the question. First question is, did you cut him off? Did you say, hey, I can't get information, you know?
Right.
And other than the guy telling you to throw the black and blue jig, did you violate the no information rule? That sort of the deal. But back to your question, I think it's just one of the tools.
Right.
And I think it's been effective. Yes.
Yeah. Now I know the answer to this, but we've got a lot of people listening and watching, and I want you to address it here. And I already know the answer, but over the years, you know, there's always conspiracy theories that, you know, there were rigged polygraphs. I remember, you know, an FLW angler coming back to Bass and there was an incident and, you know, it was because of the FLW thing. I never believed any of that was true, but how have you dealt with those things over the years? Because that's a tough criticism, you know?
Well, your answer is right. They were definitely 100% not rigged.
Right.
You know, unless there was a call for a polygraph, they were all strictly random. The examiner had the general questions way ahead of time before the tournament ever happened. So, you know, we would let the anglers draw out the boat numbers for the people to be examined on that day. If your boat was boat number 15 and the angler reached in our bag of poker chips that were 1 through 100 and drew out 15, then you had to take the random polygraph.
Yeah.
And the questions were generic. They mostly evolved around the no information rule.
Yeah.
And a few other tournament, quite relevant tournament specific questions, but no, they were never rigged. I can tell you that.
Yeah. I've taken a bunch and I can remember it was all the worst polygraphs I've ever took over the years. Was I would always get drawn the second day for my polygraph when I didn't make the cut. So I was always so pissed off that I didn't make the cut, and then I had to stick around for the polygraph. I was like, why does this always happen to me like this?
Your heartbeat's already through the
roof.
Yeah,
like I'm already like disgusted, right? Because I'm not gone on the fish the next day.
Throwing action figures out your window.
It was like every time. It was like every damn time, I swear.
Oh, they're going to get the best of you.
Oh, God. That's how it happened. I swear. It pissed me off. I want to switch it real quick and talk about some positive stuff. Tripp, you have worked with bass a long time. You've seen so many amazing anglers, amazing talents come up over the years. Gosh, from Brian Kershaw to Kevin Van Dam to, you know, Aaron to Skeet. You've seen so many of these guys over the years. Did you know, like, early on, like, when you first, you know, were at an event with Kevin, did you know back then that he was going to become one of the best in the world? Did you know these guys were going to be this good, or did it just develop over time?
Well, you know, my history with Kevin, my first tournament was the 91 Classic in Baltimore, which was his first classic.
Yep.
Chesapeake Bay. He was a young hotshot, yep. but early on I knew about him. Absolutely. I mean, you know, he was just so good, but, a lot of you guys were. You were one of them. I mean, so many anglers, and I tell people all the time, man, it was a honor and a pleasure. You know, it was honor to just be right there with the legends. You know, Roland Martin and Rick Flunn and Larry Nixon and all those guys. And then I had the great pleasure of seeing young anglers become legends in the sport. So I've been fortunate in my life. In the bass fishing world.
Yeah, that's awesome. Were there any anglers, Tripp, that were short-lived in the sport that could have been greats? I know, you know, we get guys every year that'll be in for a year or two, and then for whatever reason they go a different direction in life. Do you remember any specifically that you thought could have been a great?
You know, it's none come to mind at the top of my head, but you mentioned Brian Kershaw and being there when he won the Classic. And that was so cool because the Federation was so, so strong at that time. And when he won, and just, you know, he's such a good looking kid and had such a bright future and so tragic. I'll never forget the day at Bass when I walked in the office and Don Corkin gave me that news that he had tragically died in a plane crash. And man, it was a somber mood around Bass headquarters for a long time.
Yeah, it was here in the Northeast too, because we're all Federation guys here. And man, I remember it, Pete. You know, I remember. In fact, Brian, I remember like it happened, and then we had like a club meeting.
Yeah.
It was either the week it happened or the next week. I think it was right after.
It was our club banquet.
Was it our banquet?
Yeah. November, December.
Yeah.
Something like that.
And man, I remember just the feeling of emptiness, you know, because he, for the guys in the Northeast, Trip, I mean, he was a representative of the National Federation, but he was a representative of the Northeast. He was us. He was one of us, you know.
Absolutely.
He was an underdog.
He was an underdog, and he was a Northerner. He was a Yankee. He worked at the freaking Ground Round, for crying out loud.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
And I remember what a tragedy it was, but it was also an inspiration for a lot of guys. Pete, I know he was an inspiration for you as well.
He clearly was. As a matter of fact, every time I see one of those culprit worms, I think of him.
Yeah, you know? Or the whistle. When I see the
whistle.
The whistle. I just, this one right there. Yeah.
There you go.
That's awesome.
Right. Got it.
Hit it, Pete.
Yeah.
Give it two toots real quick. There you go.
Tripp, speaking of powerful forces, you got to spend a lot of time, I would imagine, with Ray Scott. And I mean, tell me about that. I mean, you know, the monumental force in this sport created something for us all.
Yeah, well, you know, it goes way back really to my childhood in Montgomery, Alabama. And Ray Scott, I grew up in Capitol Heights. Ray Scott grew up in Capitol Heights. So we shared a lot of life stories, you know, about growing up in Montgomery and a lot of the people we knew, and golly, I knew all of his family. He was, when I came on board at Bass, he was MC in tournaments. He no longer owned Bass. He had sold it to Helen and Carl Dabbs and the Jemison group. And, but I'd see him at tournaments, see him at Bass headquarters, and we spent a lot of time together. You know, I was very lucky and I guess in that respect to be around Ray Scott all those years.
I was fortunate to come across the stage and he weighed me in, and I was, you know, that was a monumental thing for me. And you know, where's the sport going, Tripp? I mean, we've got a lot going on now. We've had a third tournament trail enter the game. Where are we going with this thing?
Well, I hope it's going to great things. I mean, we put the fans in the boat, and that was a monumental step. I mean, that was always the big challenge, getting the fans in the boat and with the live stuff. I hope it goes to great things. I hope we don't hit a recession like we did in 2008, because that was tough on a lot of guys. And I know it's tough on these anglers right now with gas prices going up like they are. And so, you know, I hope we see more and more great stuff, because being a tournament junkie, I still watch a bunch of it.
Yeah.
Me too. Remember that in 08? I remember the recession of 08, losing all the sponsors and gas prices being at almost $5 a gallon.
Oh, man, we went to California. Mike can tell you. I mean, out there in California, you're almost $5 a gallon.
Yeah.
And that's once you get to California. You're from New Jersey to California is a long way, right, Mike?
Yeah, it's a 40-hour drive.
It's a long way.
And a lot of gas. Yeah. A lot of gas.
That's a long way. Tripp, of all the, you know, Bass has changed hands a little bit over the years. Of all the ownership groups that you've worked with, was there one owner that really stood out as being, you know, critical in the growth of the sport?
Well, I go back to my beginning in 91 and Helen Sevier. Helen's leadership, and I'm so glad she got in the Hall of Fame. It was way past due, in my opinion. She should have been in there really from day one. But I know when Ray hired her, Bass took off. She was a marketing genius. ESPN days were fun. It was certainly cool to be part of ESPN, you know, but then when Jerry and Don and Jim Copeland bought Bass, it was Don Logan, still a very close friend of mine. Jerry was a great friend, and I miss him and things he did, you know, around the sport. And that's where all the lives started with JM but Chase and those guys, they're great. So I enjoyed, you know, working through all of the ownerships. It's funny. I was talking to somebody and I said, I've had like, when I was at Bass, I had like 16 different bosses. I had a list of the people I reported to over my 30 year span.
Yeah.
And, so it's changed a lot, but I guess I did something right. They never got rid of me. So I enjoyed it.
That's awesome. I think every owner that comes in does something to advance the sport a little bit, and it just keeps growing. So, Tripp, will you do me a favor? Will you hang in there with us for one more segment? We have a special guest we're going to bring on, Tripp, for you. Hang in there with us, because I think this next segment's going to be good. If you're watching tonight, hope you're having a wonderful Sunday. We've got the one and only Tripp Weldon with us. Hang in there. When we come back from this short commercial break, more Ike Live.
4.5-inch drop shot worm. Bama bug. Finesse jig, PB&J. Give me something hard. Hey, Divvy D here. I didn't always know this much about fishing. 4-aught EWG worm hook. In fact, there was a time when I couldn't tell the difference between a jerkbait and a stickbait. But then I signed up for Mystery Tackle Box, the original monthly tackle subscription. And now
I know more about fishing than I do about Calculus.
And he knows a lot about Calculus.
Plus, I get amazing extras, like free fishing magazines.
October 2016. Featured article, 4 places to throw a frog.
Exclusive decals.
Zombie bass.
And how-to videos for all the great baits I receive.
How to tune a crankbait. Is that underwater footage I smell?
I got goosebumps.
So if you're looking to develop enhanced fishing abilities like me, or you just like getting new tackle every month, go to MysteryTackleBox.com and get your box today.
Ooh, live minnows. Is it lunchtime already?
Nature's candy.
Oh. Is he in my pocket?
This time of year, I definitely recommend putting a little bit of this on your soft plastics, too. There he is. Another one. Next cast. And that would be number 6. I'm addicted. I'll admit it. I'm straight addicted.
This might be bigger.
You think so?
Yeah.
Oh my god, that's such a healthy fish. Look at the size.
Put a little liquid mayhem on your crappy jig and look where the stripers get it. You can't even see it, man.
That might be a keeper.
This is your tackle. Not that kind of tackle. You use it to catch this, or this, or this. You also use this, and that, and these. This is your environment. So is this. You love it, live for it, but it will turn this into that. This is the Flambeau Z-Rust Max Tuftainer Series. These are fully infused with exclusive Z-Rust VCI anti-corrosion technology. This is a U.S. naval battleship. The same Z-Rust technology used here has been used on those to protect advanced weapon systems from corrosion in conditions like these. For the fish, it's invisible, odorless, tasteless. And for you, it's FDA-safe anti-rust protection for a minimum of 5 years. This is the next level of tackle management. Not that kind of management. This is the Flambeau legacy of tackle systems. What's your tackle worth?
It's more than who you are. It's who you're with. And it's more than what you do. It's where you do it. Tin Cup Mountain Whiskey.